Excuse me. Welcome everybody to our 2013 Heritage Day. I'm Bill Shrewsbury, and as chair-elect for the Baton Rouge AIS office, it's part of my responsibility to set this thing up, of which I had a great deal of help. Geraldine, Kathleen, Bill, all of you there here. Will you join me in a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Kay, would you come up here and do a little presentation for Heritage Day? Talk.
Little.
Okay, I'm used to Bill. I'm KB, and I asked Bill if I could just speak for a short while because I'm trying to collect some information as far as the history goes of Al-Anon in our whole area. And out there in the entranceway are two forms. One is a group history form. You can also find these online at the member's website, the Al-Anon state website. This would give information that we could then store and save and hopefully then have published and worked out. The group history all across the state, and we're losing that information. You all can help us to start wherever you are. The other one is a longtime member questionnaire, and it's two sides, and you can make up your own. I've received some that have been their own little ideas, but this would be what you remember when you started in Al-Anon. And I really encourage you to just pick these up, take them to your meetings and to your groups, and if you ever need more, they're on the members' website. The one other thing, Bill, is there's a big poster out there, and it has pictures of all the earlier AIS offices in Baton Rouge, because this is our Heritage Day here. And that is done so that you can put your name by the pictures of where that office was when you started within the Al-Anon Fellowship. So if you don't remember where the office was, the dates are there, and maybe some other friend can help you. But we're just doing this ongoing. And I really thank you and realize that it is through understanding our past that we can have a much brighter and better future. Thank you.
Thank you, Kay. Well, when I accepted this chair-elect service position, it was a real opportunity for me. I want you to know that Al-Anon, through the 12 steps in our recovery, there's a different Bill that is up here today than those who were here when Bill came to these meetings 8 years ago. I am not near the you-know-what I used to be. And I got the opportunity to accept service in Al-Anon 7 years ago. I've been in this program 8 years. So they tell me having the opportunity to accept service sounds better than being conned into service. But one of the things I remember is the lady says, I think Bill should be a GR. And there's two men who are both gone, raise their hands. And both of those men gave me a lot of recovery. They were Grady H. and Bill Dunn. And I got into area assembly, and I absolutely hated it. But you know, that is my duty. And I know one of the ladies, she said, Bill, we love you anyway. So that has special meaning to our closing, but I got the opportunity to request our speaker, and I invite Cliff, because shortly after I got into area assembly, he was our delegate, which God knows how he has the patience to deal with that at the World Service Hall. But he came, and he reported, and he is also now the chair of the Al-Anon Area Assembly. In those 6 years of his service as the delegate to World Service Organization, and in a few more months, his 3 years as chairperson of the Al-Anon Area Assembly, I've seen a great deal of growth. So I've asked him to come share his Al-Anon story with us. Cliff.
Thank you, Bill. What an introduction. My name's Cliff, and I'm a very grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon Family Groups, and I'm privileged to be here today to speak to you guys, and I'm really privileged that y'all showed up today to hear me. And I want to thank Bill again, because this is part of my recovery. When I speak, it helps me just as if it might help someone else. My home group is Elon Park. We meet in Metairie, Louisiana, 6200 Camphor Street. If you have an area, stop in and see us Friday night, 8 p.m. My recovery started May 5th, 1995, and I'm a very grateful member to my group. First thing I'd like to say, you know, whenever I sponsor somebody, I tell them, let's take a quick look, because they're really not ready at the 12th step. And it says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. Now, I didn't realize what that meant until I got to step 12. So I tell my sponsees, look at it first before we start step 1, because on the way, you're going to have little miracles. And that's those spiritual awakenings that we have. And all through the steps, we get those miracles. So I want them to be aware that things are happening in their life as they're working the steps. Today, I'm here. My higher power is going to talk through me to you. And it might be only one person in this room that hears something that's going to change their life. And I'm just a messenger. I'm bringing the story, and it's up to you to hear it. I like humor in this program, so I'm going to start off with a little joke, kind of lighten things up a little bit. If you don't get it, raise your hand, and I'll explain it to you. Oh, we already started. Okay. There's two AAs and an Al-Anon out cruising around on a Friday night in their car.
Al-Anon's wrong.
I mean, the Al-Anon's telling them, you guys, you know, you got to do this, you got to do that, you know. We just trying to control them, tell them what to do, and they're getting bored, and they want excitement. You know, the AAs like excitement. They want excitement, so they're riding around for a couple hours, and they pull in front of this liquor store. So the Al-Anon goes bananas. You're going to ruin your recovery. You're going to relapse out of the whole bitch, you know. They jump out the car. They run in. They hear gunfire. And so they come running out. One of them's got a bag of cash in his hand. The other one's got 2/5 of liquor. They jump in the car, and they take off. Man, they start drinking. Man, they got their excitement. And the Al-Anon's in the back preaching the whole time. They maybe get 2 miles down the road to get pulled over. They go to jail and go to trial. They can get convicted of murder. So the judge sends them to death in the electric chair. So when the execution day came, the three of them are sitting there, and they got the minister and the executioner and the warden all standing there. And they bring the first AA up. He's sitting down in the chair. They strap his hands in. And they said, do you have anything to say for yourself? He says, well, I'm really sorry for what I've done. You know, and whatever consequences I have to bear, I'm ready. So the executioner says, okay. And the warden gives him the signal. And he pulls the switch. Nothing happens. So the warden looks over at the minister and says, what do we do now? And the minister says, well, this is God's will. And so the warden says, you know what? It sure is. Go out and live a good life. You're free to go. Should have bring the next AA up. They sit him down, strap him in, and they said, you got anything to say for yourself? Same thing. I'm really sorry. You know, I'm ready for whatever consequences I need to suffer. So they say, okay. So they pull the switch. Nothing. Same thing, bro. You're free to go. You know, this is God's will that you live. So now it's the Al-Anon's turn. They bring them up. They get the Al-Anon there. Sit them down. Strap them in. And say anything you want to say. She said, yeah, you see that switch on the wall? If you turn that switch on, this chair will work perfectly. So, you know, sometimes in our life, we try to fix things that are detrimental to us. And our control issues sometimes put us in harm's way. But anyway, so, you know, how it was. I was born in 1950. And my mother and father were not rich people. They were fairly poor. My dad joined the service when he was 17, dropped out of school. And when he got out of the service, he went to school on a GI Bill, and he became an accountant. My mother had a previous marriage, so I had a sister before they were even married. I didn't know that she was a half-sister until I was an adult, but when I came along, I had her, and then I had a younger sister that came about 7 years later. So there were three of us in the family, three siblings. My older sister stayed in trouble quite a bit, and I was asked to help out at a very young age. So I became a caretaker, very young. My dad had anger issues. I don't know if he was an alcoholic or not. I've heard a lot of stories. But when I came along, all I can remember is the anger that he had, and it was a tremendous amount of anger. And there was a lot of screaming going on. I can remember from when I was just crawling. And my grandparents lived in the back. There was a home that they had built in the back of where my parents lived. And my grandmother used to come get me and take me out of the house when this was going on. I don't know when it was, but I do know that I was in school. And I think it was about in the fourth grade. My dad used to, when he'd get angry, and if I had done something wrong, he liked to use the belt. So he would take me in this small bathroom, grab me by one hand, and whip me with the belt. And the fourth grade, I failed the fourth grade. So I remember one time I came home with a report card, and he started with this belt. And the next day when I woke up, my pajama pants were stuck to my legs, and I didn't know why. And when I looked, I had bled into the pants. So his anger was really out of control. Do I think he loved me? Sure. Did he mean to do what he did? No. It was an anger and it was rage. And I don't know where he got it from, but he had it all his life until he died. I inherited some of that anger, and I can remember being about 8 years old. And we used to go to a local movie house, and we'd go see the movies, and when we came out, my dad expected us to be waiting on the curb where he would park to get in the car to go home. So my oldest sister was not with me one time, and I went, and I got into some disagreement with two young guys, well, maybe a year older than I was, and they got mad at me and said, we're gonna beat you up. So after the show, they were waiting outside for me, and I was scared. They had two of them, they were older than me, and even though it was only a year, at that time a year meant a lot. So when my dad pulled up, I wasn't waiting at the curb. And when I seen him pull up, I ran out to the car and we drove off. He said, why weren't you waiting? And so I told him the story, you know, these two guys are gonna beat me up. He turned the car around, he goes back. He says, you don't never run away from a fight, you're gonna fight. And I had to fight both of them boys right outside the car. This went on constantly. I could never back down, so he built up, he made me, and the word I want to use is mean. He put a mean streak in me, made me angry and mean. When I got in high school, I started playing football, and that intensified. The violence of the sport just intensified inside me, and I loved it. I love to be mean. That's part of my makeup now. And I can remember I played football at East Jefferson High School. And I remember one night, it was before school started, and we were out on the field, and the coach turned the lights on. It was a summer practice before the season started. And he said, "We're not going home till we see blood." Now, that's not a good message to give a kid that's already mean. It just gave me a reason to start swinging. And we ended up probably about 2 hours with nighttime practice till we could go in. So that's a little background on what happened to me as a child. And so between the caretaking of my two sisters, which I was asked to do, and the anger and the mean streak I had in me, I was starting off my life in a bad way. Met a girl in high school. We started dating. And when I would go over to her house, I thought her dad was so cool. He had graduated from Notre Dame. He had moved down to Louisiana to work in the oil industry. He was a chemical engineer. And he did very well, made a lot of money. But he was a heavy drinker and a heavy gambler. So he might be offshore for a week or two, and when he came home, he liked to play. At 17 years old, I thought that was cool. Drinking, partying, gambling. So I envisioned that as a way of life. And he was an alcoholic, I know that now, and it created a divorce between him and his wife. My girlfriend moved in with her mother, and we became sexually active at that time. And she came home one night and caught us in bed and said, "Well, we're getting married." I was 18, she was 17. My parents said, "No way, we're not signing. In the state of Louisiana, you got to be 21 at that time." So she took us to Orange, Texas, got us married. Well, I wasn't ready. She wasn't ready. Thank God we never had any children. That lasted about 3 months. So now I got one notch on my belt, divorce. That's my first marriage, you know, so I guess you're getting a hint there's going to be a few more. So shortly later, I met a girl from South Carolina. I just loved that little accent. And we ended up getting married. Her mother found out we were dating, found out I had been previously married. I was 20, she was 17. Moved back to South Carolina. So what did I do? Pack up my car and move up there. Yeah, whatever your mom says, you know, I'll do by your rules, you know. So we did that, and she graduated from high school. We got married, and the economy got real bad there. Now, I had been working in the air conditioning field ever since I was in high school in the summer months. So I had, you know, worked up a little trade experience, and I had went to work for Sears up in South Carolina. And I think I spent as much time in school as I did working, because they always had some kind of class where you could go to learn about the different appliances and the heating products and cooling products. So I said, "Hey, you're going to send me to school? I'm going to go." So I got a lot of education there. And then when the economy got mad, the textile industry was big there, where they made carpets and sheets and this type of stuff for homes. And the economy got bad. The stuff started coming in from China and Taiwan. So they started laying off. And I said, "Well, you know, there's always New Orleans. That's where I'm from." So I came down here and applied for a job. Well, New Orleans was doing great because of the oil industry. And they hired me right off. "Yeah, you come on, we'll transfer you." So I came down to New Orleans and started working at Sears. And I was doing real well. We bought a house. First child came along. Second child came along, and I said, "Man, salary I'm making is not quite enough." So I started moonlighting, doing side work. Ended up, I said, "Okay, I'm ready." I started my own business in 1976. And by then, we had four children. My wife got involved in politics. She got elected in the city of Harahan as an alderman, which is like a councilman in bigger towns. And she started making trips to Baton Rouge and going up to Washington. I mean, she really got involved in this, and it really created a burden on our marriage. And I was no angel. I still had this temper that I had learned as a small child, and as a teenager, and so I could get angry and do some damage in the home. I never did hit her, but if I'd get angry, I could punch a hole in the wall real quick. And I heard a speaker one time share about whiteouts. I said, what in the world is a whiteout? And that's when you have no alcohol in you, but you do something and you really don't remember it. And I had punched 4 or 5 holes in a door, and my hand was all swollen. And the next day I said, what happened? She told me, she said, you punched the door. And I really didn't even remember it. So that's how bad my temper was. I mean, it just could fly off the handle at the simplest thing. So consequently, and I don't blame her, probably more me because of my temper, we ended up divorcing. Met someone real quick, and they call it the rebound, I think. Got married, lasted a year. Her thing was, well, you know, you got children. I said, no, my children come first. She said, I'm okay with that. That's great. Well, my oldest son is manic depressive, and he has his episodes, especially when he'll take his medication. And my oldest daughter, at the time, was starting to show signs of addiction. I had no idea what it was at that time because I hadn't been exposed to it. Consequently, my son moved in, my daughter moved in, and she says, I'm done. I can't deal with these kids. So she moved out, divorce number 3. We're getting there. Just hold on. So I'm pretty much, you know, ladies, I'm done with you guys. I haven't had enough, you know. I mean, one of them's got the house, you know, one of them's got the car, the other one's got the other house. So, I learned one thing, what's mine is hers and what's hers is hers. So now my daughter's a teenager and she's my oldest daughter. I still got 2 younger ones. And she meets this girl in school and they become friends. And I guess they're around the 15 mark, 15 years old. And their addiction's getting worse and I'm starting to be watching them, not sleeping at night and what have you. So they get this idea. My daughter's friend's mother is single. They don't get together, right? Yeah, I put it off a few times. I said, no, I'm really not interested right now. I got enough on my plate. And by now, the other two have moved in with me. So my ex-wife is busy with her politics, and I've got all 4 kids. So they hook up a date with me and this lady, and we go out. And the deal was, they told me, she likes to dance. They told her, I like to dance. And we do. We both do. So we went out. We had a nice dinner, and we went to this little club. And I think I got a beer, and she ordered iced tea. And the waitress says, well, we don't serve iced tea, but we have what they call Long Island iced tea. So she gets one of these, and then she gets 2, and I'm still on my first beer. And she done put down about 4 or 5 of these. Well, I didn't know, but in her previous marriage, she had had a breakdown, and she had went through a mental institution and a couple of years of that, and she was also an alcoholic. Her ex-husband was an alcoholic. He was in AA. She did some time in AA to get clean. She was clean when I met her. I learned that her father was an alcoholic, and he was really a bad alcoholic, but with a real bad temper, very similar to what mine was. And maybe that was a trait she saw in me that she liked. I don't know. But anyway, she started drinking. And when they say this disease is progressive, she started not where she was, but where she should have been if she would have kept drinking. And I thought it was cool. You know, I remember the days back when old Charlie was having a good old time, you know, gambling and partying and having fun. So we would go out and have a good time. Well, I couldn't keep up with her. I mean, I couldn't drink like that, you know, and I had too much to drink. I'd get sick. So I said, something's got to give here. Well, then the accident started. They put the car in the canal one time. Then the 2 daughters were very active. Matter of fact, the 3 of them would go out together, stay out all night. So it got to a point where my mother-in-law said, hey, I'm willing to put her in treatment. Now, I was foreign to all this treatment stuff, so I was doing research, and they had an out-treatment program in Metairie, Louisiana called New Freedom. Some of you might have heard of it, and she started going. And my temple was really out of control. And the counselor that she had, you know, we had family night on a Thursday night, so I went in, and the counselor was listening to us, and I was, man, that dad of yours is a no-good SOB, drinking all the time, beating up your mother, and look at you, man, you're nothing but an alcoholic, man, you know, you drink all the time, it's disgusting. And the guy looks over at me, and he says, looks at her, you don't need him. He's not helping you in this recovery at all. Get rid of him now. Man, I'm devastated. I'm saying, what is he talking about? I'm the best thing in her life. You know, I'm taking care of her. I think that was the first sign that I realized maybe, a little bit maybe, there was something wrong with me. So they recommended, I said, hey, look, you tell me what I need to do. I've had already 3 failed marriages. I want to make this work. And she really was a good person. She just had this disease that she could not control, impossible by herself. So they recommended that I go to Al-Anon. So, and they give me something to read, and they say, AA of how it works. So I read this, and it hits me. I think I'm in the wrong room. So they all start laughing immediately. I said, you need to go upstairs. Well, unfortunately, when I got up there, they had already finished the introductions. They had already finished the steps. They had already finished the welcome. And they were already on a topic. And, you know, all I know is they kept talking about what they had done wrong. I said, many people are crazy, you know. They don't know what they're talking about. So when I left that meeting, I had decided, Al-Anon's not for me. Now, the 2 girls, my daughter and my stepdaughter, had gotten real bad. I remember coming in early one afternoon, and we had a long coffee table, and they had 2 young guys sitting there, and they had every frickin' pill you can imagine laid out on this table. They had the little white packets. I mean, they had all this drug stuff there. And crazy as I was, I went over there, and I just took my arm, and I raked all the stuff in a grocery bag. I said, this is mine now. And the one of the young guys there, I took his beeper. That's when they had beepers, you know, them things that beep beep. And I stuck the beeper in my pocket. I said, you 2 out of here. Well, and I wasn't afraid of anything. I mean, I had gotten mean, you know. I get that all that anger and stuff in me. I was ready for anything. So when they got up to walk out, that one guy had, I could see the gun in his pocket. With the stub of the gun, the handle of the gun sticking out, didn't even faze me. But I know now, it had been nothing for him to turn around and shoot me. I mean, I don't know how many thousands of dollars of drugs I just took from him. So now I'm going to Al-Anon. I finally decide, I mean, the pain has gotten so great, I can't sleep at night. I'm listening for the doors to open. I'm chasing these girls in the ballrooms. My wife's active. I mean, it's a zoo. Now, she's got 3 children, and they've moved in. So we've got 7 kids, and we're living in a 3-bedroom condo, 1,700 square feet. And when I'm telling you it's a zoo, it's a zoo. And I'm trying to control everything. You know, I'm pulling the levers and doing the whole bit. So, you know, maybe this Al-Anon stuff might work. So that's when I went to where my home group is, Allen Park, my first meeting. Didn't get a clue of what they were talking about. All I know is they were laughing, they were having fun, and they were having recovery. I said, I have no clue what y'all talking about, and they kept coming back. I said, won't come back. Kept going back. And I had got to the point where I was still trying to fix things. It just wasn't sinking in. You know, I wasn't getting the message. And somebody was talking about a program out at SUNO, that's a local college in New Orleans, and they have the drug program over there, you know, intro to drugs and alcoholism, the disease counselor, all the courses you take to be a counselor. I need to be a counselor. I can fix them. So what do? I go enroll in the courses, take the courses, and I'm in my 2nd semester, and I'm about to finish alcoholism, the disease concept. And the instructor, who was a very nice guy, I forgot to tell you this, when I first went to school, they interview you. So he comes up and he says, so you a friend of Bill W.'s? I said, man, who in the hell's Bill W.? Well, he knew right then he had a challenge. But anyway, so I'm about to finish this second course, and he tells me, he says, you know, you don't get it. I said, what do you mean I don't get it? I'm making straight A's. I got it, man. I'm going to fix these guys, you know? So he says, no, here's what I want you to do. I want you, we got about a month left. I want you to go once a week to an open AA meeting, and then I want your final paper to be written on what you learned. I can do that. Piece of cake. So I started going to these meetings, and I lived in Harahan, and there was a local meeting right close on Sunday night. That was perfect. It was in River Oaks. It was a treatment center. So I went. Well, it's a step study meeting. So it went in January. So I got step one, you know. Okay, we're doing step one. Okay. So the guy running the meeting is a graduate. I say graduate. He had went to River Oaks. And this was part of his way he was giving back to the program. He was running the meetings. So we went through step one, step two. We got on step three, and he says, hey, man, I'm going out of town. Can you run the meeting? Because you see, all the people in the meeting are patients. So after 30 days, they're rotating. They're getting out. So it's new people every 30 days. So he says, can you run the meeting for me Sunday night? Yeah, I can do that. So he called me the following week. Can you run it again? I end up doing the steps, 12 steps of AA through that year. Okay, running that meeting. Now here I am in Al-Anon in an AA group with all these people. But let me tell you what I learned. I learned that these alcoholics literally, with tears in their eyes, okay, saying, I don't know why I do this. You know, I get clean and I swear I'm not going to do it. I apologize to my spouse, to my girlfriend, whoever it is. I swear I'm not going to do it. And on the way home, the magical angel takes over my car and turns into the barroom. This started getting into my head. Maybe there's something here about this disease stuff. And just hearing them over and over. And I can see, I can feel what they're sharing. I mean, they're coming from here. And they're really hurting. They want to get well. They want to stop, but they can't. And it's funny, you know, the alcoholics sit over here. The drug addicts sit over here. I'm not no drug addict, but I ain't no alcoholic. So you got these two fashions. It's a disease. It's a disease of addiction. They got it. I don't care if it's a drug or if it's alcohol or what it is. They got this disease, and they can't deal with it. So I start looking at this program. I really start looking at it, and then I realize I really need a sponsor because, you know, these steps are not making sense to me. I'm powerless. I'm never powerless. All I got to do is get off my butt and make it happen. So I said, okay, it's time. I got to get a sponsor. So the District 7, which is the West Bank of Jefferson Parish, was having a workshop. So I'm going to go to this workshop. It's on sponsorship. Now, I've been in the program 3 years now. So I go to this workshop, and they break us up into groups. So I go with this one group, and I'm sure a lot of you people know this person that was head of this group. Her name was Marna, and she was a past delegate. Well, I didn't know who she was. So we doing this workshop, and they talking about getting a sponsor and what a sponsor should do and how you work the steps and all. And so after we had finished, she asked me, she says, well, do you have a sponsor? I never said you had heard you say you had a sponsor. I said, well, I got this lady in the program I call, and you know, she helps me through the steps. She listens to my problems and kind of guides me, you know. And she says, well, let me tell you something. That's your sponsor. I said, yeah, but she said she'd never sponsor a man. I said, well, you know, you look like you're an adult to me. You go tell her or ask her, is what she said, to be your sponsor. And she's an adult, you're an adult, and y'all behave yourself. I said, okay, I can do that. And so I did. And I went and asked her, and she says, okay. She says, we've been meeting together long enough that three conditions. One, clear this with your wife first, and I need to talk to her. Two, If this relationship ever becomes anything other than sponsorship, she had heard part of my story in those meetings. It's over. And number three, when I ask you to do something in Al-Anon, no questions, you do it. Yeah, I can do that. Did I find out otherwise? So we start meeting and we start working the steps. Man, a miracle's starting to happen. I'm getting better. So we meeting, we working the steps, working the steps, working the steps. Things are getting better at home, but they're really not. They're getting worse. The wife's on a third DWI. She's got one of them bracelets around her ankle. And I bring her home, and so they tell me, you know, she can't leave the house. She's got to stay in this perimeter. And the guy that was her probation officer, he tells her, this was on a Friday, I'm going out of town, I'll see you Monday. So he leaves, I leave, I go to work. I get a phone call 30 minutes later, you need to come home. She's loaded. Where she got the pills, I don't know. You know, they got ways of hiding everything. So he says, you got 24 hours to get her in treatment. I said, boy. So in the meantime, I'm working the steps. I'm starting to find out that a lot of this is not my responsibility. I know she can't handle jail time. So I start looking. East Jefferson turns her down. They see that anklet thing on her, and oh no. Now I know they're looking for her because she's out of the square she's supposed to be in. So I get my sheet metal shears out, good air conditioned guy I'm in, cut it off. So bring her down to Tulane, and Tulane says, well, is she going to commit suicide? I said, she might. We say, that's good enough. So she ended up in DePaul, and she did 30 days there, and she did good. Has she had some slips in between? Sure, here and there. But she's doing well now. But in the meantime, getting back to my steps and working my steps, sitting in a meeting, and it's time for an intergroup rep, and I think y'all call AIS office here. It's time for an intergroup rep for our group. The term is up for the person that's serving. So my sponsor puts her hand up and said, oh man, she's going to be the intergroup rep. And she says, we got somebody here that can do that. And I'm going, oh boy, who is that? And she goes, he can. I said, hell, she said, remember our deal. I said, yeah, you know, we didn't have a deal. So I'm in a group rep now, and I'm serving on an intergroup level. And you know what they do? Before the intergroup meeting, they have a step study, a tradition study, and a concept study. So now I'm starting to learn about this program. And I mean, I'm starting to get suckered in, like Bill was saying. You know, I'm getting pulled into this thing. And my term's almost up. Is in a group rep, and I'm figuring, okay, I did my job. And the lady that's chairman comes to me and says, we'd like you to be chairman. So I'm an outsmarter, right? If you'll be my service sponsor, I'll do it. I sure will. So okay, so now I'm chairman of in a group, and her partner is a past delegate, okay? Her name is Mary Lynn. Her sponsor, okay, is Mary Lynn. Mary Lynn's sponsor was Myrna, who got me a sponsor, who got me involved in sponsorship. Now, if that's not a spiritual awakening, I don't know what is. I mean, God just put them things right in a row like he was supposed to. I could have never done that on my own, for sure. So I learned a quick lesson in control. I'm not in control. My higher power, who I like to call God, is. So, and I got to tell you, I'm not a religious person. I studied several different religions. I gave up on God a long time ago when he didn't do it my way. But I found this program. And I know if I live by these 12 steps and I give myself to my fellow man when he needs me, that's good enough. So anyway, so now I'm in a group rep. The chairman of intergroup, and I'm serving, and my sponsor's good with that. She says, that's good, you need to do that. But I ran it by her first, and that was one of them things. Remember what I told you? Do what I say, you do it. So then I become she recommends I be liaison to Area Assembly. So I start taking the message from Area Assembly back to Intergroup. And I served that for 2 years. And about the middle of that, I served as a GR for another group. So as my GR term was up, we were electing a new DR, and she took it, and then after about 2 weeks, she had to resign. So, you know, everybody's looking at me, and my service sponsor said, you can do that. So then I'm DR, you know, so I'm serving as a DR. And all this time, I'm working these steps, and I'm learning about myself. And when I get to step 6 and step 7, you know, I'm entirely ready for this freaking anger bit and mean bit to go away. And I'm still got this. It's getting a little better, but I still got this deal, you know. When something don't go right, I'm pissed, man. You know, and the hands don't feel good when you punch walls. So I'm starting to work on this anger thing, and my sponsor's working with me, and we work on it. She says, okay, there's nothing you can do about it, but turn it over. You know, you let it go now. You're entirely ready. It'll go. And so I learned from her, okay, to be aware when it happens. She says, where does it happen at? I said, it starts here, down here. You know, I feel it here. She says, okay, when you feel it there, stop yourself. Say it's a serenity prayer. Okay, you're aware it's happening. Back up. Okay? Accept whatever the situation is. Accept it. Then take the action. And the action might be walk away. Take a deep breath. Say the serenity prayer. Let go and let God. Whatever slogan you need to use, you use it. And if you can't find one, pick the phone up and call me. So that's what I started doing. And you know, one day, another little miracle. It was gone. And I woke up one morning, and no matter what happened, I didn't get mad. I mean, it wasn't angry. It was mad. You know, like the dog. I didn't get mad. It wasn't there. It was, okay, what's the solution? That's another thing my sponsor taught me. Get out of the problem, get in the solution. I started getting in the solution. It started working. I mean, it was gone. The anger is gone. That is a miracle. It's no longer exists. Don't get upset, sure. Don't get angry. And don't get mad. I don't ever have another whiteout ever again. So that in itself is a miracle that I was talking about. So now I'm DR. So we had Area Assembly, and I'm having a good old time. I sit in the back. I'm a big cheese, and I can play and have fun. And anybody that was at Assembly but me knew it, I like to play, you know, goof around. Oh, what a surprise. I'm figuring the end of my term's coming, I'm going to rest. You know, I've done enough service work. Son of a gun, my service sponsor's in Oregon now. Mind you, they moved to Oregon. I get a phone call one night. Hey, I know your term's getting ready to, what are you going to do next? Well, I thought I would rest up. Rest? Are you out of your mind? You just did DR. Now the whole game's open. Get busy. Figure something out and call me back. Now, I'm dealing with, I had had open heart surgery at that time about 7 years. It's 10 years now. I was 52. And I had made my mind up when I woke up that, you know, God's not finished with me. Because if he was, I wouldn't be here. I thought he was, though. You know, when they come into the recovery room, and big black guys, they look like football players. You know, walking in. I guess there's mucus they got to clean out. And this was kind of a quick open heart surgery because I didn't know what was going on. So the doctor really didn't have time to tell me what to expect. And this guy, they talking and laughing. He reaches down and pulls that tube out. Well, when you're on a respirator, you can't breathe when the tube's going. So this is it. I'm done. It's over. You know, at least I got rid of the anger. But I made it. I'm here, so I made it. And I'm here to say that was a revelation that, you know what? I'm here for a reason. I have no doubt. I'm standing here today. This is part of the reason. So then I'm trying to make up my mind what I'm going to do. Now this is bringing you back forward 7-8 years. And I'm having trouble walking. You know, my leg is killing me. You know, I'm starting to take all this Tylenol, and I'm taking 8, 10, 12 Tylenols a day. And so we had Hurricane Katrina, and my primary physician left. They all telling me, you got to live with it. You broke your leg when you was a kid, and this is an old injury, and it's you're going to have to live with this. You're getting older. So I go to this new primary doctor, and I'm telling him, man, you know, doc, man, sometimes I can't even stand up, you know. He says, I'm going to send you to an orthopedic specialist. So I walk in the room. Now, this is another one of those spiritual awakenings. I walk in the room, and this guy looks at me. He goes, you got a bad hip. I said, man, you didn't even talk to me yet. He says, you're standing, aren't you? I said, yeah. He says, well, your hips are off balance. And he says, you have pain in your leg. I'm reading the chart. I said, yeah. He says, I'm going to prove it to you. And he takes some x-rays, and sure enough, when I was a kid, I broke my left leg, and it was a compound fracture, so the break was, you know, complete. When they put it together, the hip joint didn't match correctly, so it wore my hip out. So I said, well, you know, how long can this last? He says, well, now I'm at the end of my DR term, okay? I served as a DR, and I'm coming to the end, and I've already stood for delegate. He says, well, he says, as long as you can stand the pain, you know, so I said, okay, I got 3 years. If I can do this for 3 years, I can finish my term, because I'm not knowing how I'm going to do if I get this hip replaced. I've heard some horror stories. So I said, I'm going to serve this term with this hip like it is, and I'm still taking this Tylenol. So I go in for some blood work, and the doctor says, this is 2 years into my delegate's term. I'm into my last, getting ready to go into my last year. He says, you got to do something. Go see that orthopedic. He says, man, your levels are out of sight. You're going to ruin your liver. So I go to him, and he says, yeah, we can do it now. He says, you ready? It's bone on bone. You're just going to wear the hip joint out and have a hole in the thing. I'm going to have to do repair surgery on that. So I get the hip. Now, another little spiritual awakening, another little miracle. Have this hip surgery. Go through rehab. March, I had it done in December, the end of December. March, I'm at the South Central Regional Delegates meeting. And no cane, just walking. Go to a conference in April, piece of cake. That's a miracle. Because I didn't think I was going to be able to finish that last conference. But I did. And now the hip's fine, you know, so I'm getting ready. I'm finished my delegate's term. I'm ready to rest. It's time. Get a phone call. What you going to do? I said, man, I don't think I'm going to do anything. Well, you got to find something to do. You can't quit now. You haven't done everything. So the chairman that was running our area assembly, and a lot of people know Linda N., comes to him and she says, you know, there's nobody here that's going to stay on the board. We need you to stand for chairman. I said, Linda, man, I've been doing this now 13 years, you know. She says, well, three more ain't going to hurt you. So I did. And, you know, I'm so glad I did, because one of the things I started when I was delegate, somewhere along the line, we had a disconnect with our state convention. I don't know when it happened. I don't know how it happened. But it was almost like the convention and the assembly was separate. Two separate entities completely. So I made my mind up when I became delegate. I said, I'm going to find out what this problem is. And Gail F., who was a past delegate that's from Lafayette, said, ooh, you don't want to go to them meetings. They got their own deal. They do it a certain way, you know, and you don't want to step on any toes. I said, well, I don't have a choice. You know, we need to find out what the problem is. So I appointed the chairman, because that was my job as delegate for state convention. So I called her and I said, would you mind if I come to the meeting? She says, oh, no, come on. And sure enough, I was scared because I didn't know what they were going to do to me. But come to find out, they were Al-Anons just like us. And whatever happened is in the past. I was able to make a connect with them, getting them to start coming to area assembly. Because, you know, at area assembly, we like a big spider. You know, we reach out to all the different areas, and we got those GRs out there going to their groups. So we can send that message from area assembly to all these groups a whole lot easier than they can do it from sitting in their living room trying to run this convention committee. And so Now they come regular. They come tell me, and I still go to Lafayette when they have a meeting. They have a meeting once a month, and I drive from Canada to Lafayette, and I love it. I have created some bonds there that I wouldn't trade for anything in the world. And when I go to anything on a state level, I see them, and I just love them. So now, my life today, my wife's clean. We have two recliners, and we sit there, and we watch TV. Now, she babysits a lot, so she's not always home. But the beauty of it is she can do her thing, I can do my thing. When we talk and we share, we're sharing about, well, if that's God's will, we just sit back and let it happen. And if he gives it back to us, we'll deal with it. There's no anger, there's no fighting. It's beautiful. We have, gee whiz, between the two of us, we've got about 12 grandchildren. And our kids, they don't go away. You got kids, y'all know that. They don't go away. Dad, you know, I can't pay an electric bill, you know what I mean? It's always something, which is okay. I've learned, though, I can say yes or I can say no. It all depends. I've learned that I don't have to be the guy to fix everything, you know? And they're not going to learn anything if I fix it all. So they learning. My daughter that was the alcoholic addict, she married a dealer from Texas, ended up, she had to jump in the lake in Texas in order for the Coast Guard to pick her up to get away from him. He had her locked up in a little room and would handcuff her to the door when they went out, and she got away from him, jumped in the lake, and the Coast Guard rescued her to put her in a cuckoo house over there in Dallas, Texas. And the therapist gave her the money to catch a bus to come back to New Orleans. She lived in a I guess they call it a safe house, for about a year. She's now a director in one of the drug rehabilitation programs. She goes to the jails. She's, I don't know, she's got 15, 20 women underneath her. She's doing great. My younger daughter is in and out of the disease. She's active. Right now, she seems to be okay, but she's got some charges pending. And I know when I got charges pending, they have a tendency to, you know, kind of straighten up a little bit. So I'm praying for her that she can find a recovery that my other one has found. My stepdaughter, she's a real estate agent now. She's clean. She works the program real well. She's doing good. My wife is not active in the program, but we share program talk. And I don't know if you know what that is, but program talk is when you just let things happen. You don't force things to happen. And you do it in such a manner as a loving way. So I've got a marriage that's great. You know, it took four. I finally found one. But I think that's because of me. Because I changed. Okay? And we've been married for 20 years now. So all I can say is this program brought me peace and serenity in my life. And I hope for all of you guys, y'all find it. The wind be at your back, the sun in your face, and prosper to all your perils. Thank you.
Thank you, Cliff. I'd like to thank everybody, and I'd like Carol, in her last official act as chair of Baton Rouge AIS, to come up here before she abandons us.
In the past, before Al-Anon, I would have taken on the guilt. I would have taken on the shame of that I am abandoning Baton Rouge. I am fixing to leave Baton Rouge, but I will be back. And I will be back for Heritage Day every year, you know. And I found this thing right here when I was in Alabama. And I don't know, something just told me that this would be a good thing for Cliff. And so I got it, and I'm honored that I'm going to be the one to give it to him. I was so glad when I heard Bill say that he was asking Cliff to tell his story, because I've known Cliff through area assembly for years, but I've never known him personally enough that I knew any of the details. I didn't know who his, you know, alcoholics were or anything about his story. And so I was really excited to hear. And I think it was, I was so glad that I was here to hear your story. And I would like to present you with, this is a pen. And I noticed while you were speaking that you had a pen in your pocket.
Got a pen, yeah.
And so this is from us to you, and it's from Alabama.
She didn't tell me it was from Alabama. I want to thank everybody for coming here. This is an important part of our Baton Rouge recovery. If we could gather around, I'd like to close with the We Serenity Prayer and the Al-Anon Declaration.